everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast, a weekly in-depth interview show on private equity, venture capital, and hedge fund investments in China. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Every week, I talk to a Chinese fund manager, an industry expert, or a limited partner. We discuss strategies, industries, opportunities, and challenges investing in the Chinese markets. To get our program, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to our website, chinamoneypodcast.com, and sign up to our newsletters. You can also like our official page or follow us on Twitter at ChinaMoneyPod. Our program is free. This is made possible by support from our listeners, our dear advertisers and sponsors. If you'd like to support us, it's simple. Just go to chinamoneypodcast.com and click on any of our sponsors' ads and sign up for their great services. Thank you so very much for your support. Today, we will hear some unique and interesting comments made by Jeanne Orrick, Chairman of Global Markets China at JP Morgan. She made the comments at an event hosted by the FCCC, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China, in Beijing on Monday, February 25th. Many of you are probably familiar with her. She is a veteran researcher and observer of the Chinese economy and markets, and is also an advisor to Chinese companies and government agencies. Prior to joining JP Morgan, Orrick was managing director of Greater China Equities at Deutsche Bank and also spent 8 years at Credit Lyonnais Securities Asia, heading up its research team covering China. But before that, let's just quickly go through news. News in light this past week, the most significant news is that HSBC flash PMI number weakened unexpectedly in February at 50.4 in February compared with 52.3 in January. But how much of this latest reading shows a slowdown in China's nascent economic recovery is still too early to tell, according to a report from Goldman Sachs Gao Hua just released today. Jeanne Orrick also talks a little bit about that in her comments, which we will hear. So now let's first listen to Jeanne's assessment on China's economic recovery at this point in time, whether it will continue, strengthen, or it will lose steam.
We certainly have had a rebound since, I would say, late November. It's been, underway, the recovery has been underway for a good 3 months now. I think it's important to keep in mind why we've had this recovery. I would say one of the key reasons is liquidity. There has been so much money pumped into the economy in the last several months. We've had this recovery. In fact, if you look at the government policy, we haven't had major sweeping changes, really. So one of the key reasons for the economic recovery we're seeing today is the large increase in liquidity. In December, in January, aggregate social financing, especially in January, went to an all-time high of 2.54 trillion RMB. Interestingly enough, in January, total bank lending also surged to over 1 trillion. But if you compare bank lending, which was 1.07 trillion in January, with the total aggregate social financing of 2.54, the ratio is actually quite low, meaning bank financing has become much less important to the overall liquidity picture in China. Second reason, I would say, is sentiment improvement. Since November 15th, after the 18th Party Congress, when the new leadership lineup was announced, a great deal of uncertainty was removed. So therefore, the general market had the feel-good factor. Now, 3 months into the recovery, we already have some concerns about overheating.
Onto the property sector, Jeanne thinks there are overheating in China's property sector and expects tightening measures from the government in the next few months, probably. So let's hear what her predictions are.
Sometime in the coming few months, we could have some government measures to restrict the increase in property prices. Today, it's becoming more apparent that the property market is indeed running into potential overheating territory. We think there will be additional tightening measures. Number one, they will more strictly implement the household, the restrictions on purchases. You know, those measures have never been removed. I think mid last year, the implementation was becoming a little bit more lax. And I think other cities outside of 32 cities, which are already under that restriction, could also be subject to the same restrictions when if their property prices are seen as rising too fast. And then on the financing side, I think especially for second, third mortgages, certainly the cost of financing will go up. And I think the availability of financing for people who are buying property for investment purposes will also go up. And then I would say property taxes as well are likely to be implemented on a much larger scale. Today, of course, is only two cities, Shanghai and Chongqing. I think the properties, recurring property taxes will be rolled out to a larger number of cities.
Contrary to many who think that China's infrastructure investment is coming off its peak, Jin actually believes that infrastructure investment will continue to be strong for some years to come.
In the last, say, was it 10, 15 years, infrastructural investment was really very much focused on supporting China's manufacturing sector, exports, production. In the future 10 years, I think there's a shift of infrastructural investments being supportive of people's livelihood. So if China built a lot of highways, ports, etc., in the last 10, 15 years, for the future 10 years, China will spend a lot of money on urban subways, urban rail, light rail, to help ease urban congestion, to help protect the environment, and really make people's daily lives easier, really. So I think the future infrastructure investments will not stop. The amount of money the government is spending is still going to be humongous, but the focus is changing away from supporting production, manufacturing, to more improving people's livelihood. And then, of course, a lot more money, if you look at the broad infrastructure sector, they'll put a lot of money into things like environmental protection, water conservation, improving the drinking quality of drinking water, for example.
This last comment is Jin's answer to a question on state-owned enterprise dividend. As China strives to build up its social welfare, how will it be paid? Will state-owned enterprises pay more dividend to support this effort?
The SOEs do pay, I would say, a reasonable amount of dividends based on, you know, the dividend payout ratios for the SOEs are 30-40% perhaps. I think there's an unspoken rule that companies listed on the domestic A-share market should pay 30-40% of their profits in the form of dividends. So if you look at the banks, they certainly pay a lot of dividends. If you look at the oil companies, they pay a lot of dividends. So the payout ratio, as I said, is, you know, 30-40%. China Mobile, these large cash-rich companies, are paying a good amount of dividends already. Now, the way dividends are paid, this is the listed companies pay dividends to their parent company. And then the parent company is owned by SASAC. And then SASAC, of course, is under the State Council. So how does the mechanism work? Like, we're just using a random example, okay? I don't mean to pick out one. I just say China Mobile, because it's overseas listed, very, very cash rich. China Mobile Hong Kong, CMHK, China Mobile Hong Kong, pays dividends to China Mobile Holdings. Other shareholders also get the same dividends. And then China Mobile Holdings, I guess, pays the money to SASAC. And some of that money, I know SASAC reallocates the dividends from companies that are successful, that pay a lot of dividends, to companies who perhaps are in need of cash. We all know companies in various cyclical industries, whether it's aluminum smelting or shipping, are not generating much cash. In fact, they're loss-making. So there is some reallocation of resources, so to speak, among the SOEs. But I think it's a fair assumption that China would expect the large state-owned companies to contribute more to the broad social welfare agenda. But for now, the central government has plenty of money. If you look at China's overall central government tax collection, fiscal revenue, it's very strong. And it's been growing for the past 15 years at a much faster rate than GDP. So the central government doesn't really lack the money. I think the most important thing is for us is to monitor where that money is actually going. How do they deploy the money? And the other issue is National Social Security Fund. When you have an SOE listing overseas, 10% of the proceeds go to the National Social Security Fund. So that, in a way, is supporting China's overall pension system, although, of course, the National Social Security Fund is kind of a fund of last resort. It doesn't pay out anything right now. It's really a fund of last resort. But eventually, that money should benefit the Chinese retirees.
That's today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Next week, we will hear Antoine Druin, founder of Triago, a global placement agent, and also Palico, an online marketplace for private equity communities globally, talk about Chinese private equity fundraising and also a possible blossom in secondary transactions among Chinese private equity firms. So please stay tuned. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.